wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. It is time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this July 5th Monday. This morning on the Old Mole, Bill Resnick talks to Elliot Young, co-chair of the Portland Committee on Community-Based Policing. They discuss the PSEP report to the City Council, Reimagining Community Safety, Portland Police Bureau Core Patrol Services. The report recommends replacing the police as first responders in dealing with the homeless, mental health emergencies, intoxication and addiction, and minor traffic violations. They would be replaced by people suited to and experienced in diffusing tension and helping people in crisis. July 5th is commemorated up and down the West Coast as Bloody Thursday, remembering the strikers killed in the 1934 longshore strike. Norm Diamond takes us back to that July day and to the importance of that strike. We conclude today's program with Crime and Punishment. In their Left in the Law segment this month, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker talk about the political landscape for crime and punishment in summer 2021 in the wake of the pandemic and police protests, including spikes nationally in homicides. They also take up Portland anti-police politics and current contract negotiations with the Portland Police Association, the police union, and disciplinary actions. I'm Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members, old and new, for supporting community radio and programs like the Old Mole. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Or download the Old Mole podcast and listen on the go. And now, Bill Resnick and Elliot Young.
Hi, Elliot Young. Welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having me. Good to talk to you, Bill.
Elliot Young is the co-chair of the Portland Committee on Community-Based Policing. PSEP is what it's called. Elliot will first describe, then discuss the PSEP report to the City Council. It's titled Reimagining Community Safety, Portland Police Bureau Core Patrol Services. The report recommended replacing the police as first responders in dealing with the homeless, with mental health emergencies, with intoxication and addiction, with minor traffic violations. The police would be replaced by people suited to and experienced in defusing tension and helping people in trouble. Since, in fact, most patrol officers' time and energy, most of their booking and arrests, and most of their use of weapons were in dealing with the homeless, intoxicated, and people having mental health emergencies in public. The PCCEP recommendations, therefore, if implemented, would amount to a transformation of Portland's police, which we will also talk about later. So, Elliot, tell us about the PSEP, the report for the police.
Yeah, so PSEP, as you said, was established as part of the settlement agreement with the Department of Justice, and that settlement agreement was put in place because the Department of Justice found that the city was using use of force and killing people in mental health crisis in ways that seemed unconstitutional or that were unconstitutional. And so the initial body that was set up to be the community engagement piece was called the COAB. That disintegrated and fell apart for a variety of different reasons. And this new iteration of that body, which is the PSEP, emerged about 3 years ago now. And it is under the mayor's office. He appoints the members to that body, but it is supposed to be and is an independent body of community members who are looking at establishing better communication and feedback for the police and for the police commissioner about how policing works in Portland. So in June of last year, as the George Floyd protests began, Mayor Wheeler issued a 19-point plan. One of those points was to charge PSEP with creating a process for community to come up with recommendations about Portland Police's Core Patrol Services. And what Core Patrol Services is the main function that the police does. And so back in January, we convened the public in this process, had several town halls, had regular work sessions that were all publicly accessible, and asked people initially in a survey, how do you reimagine public safety? What do you think the things that the police are doing they should continue to do? And what do you think functions of the police, other functions should be taken over by other bodies? And we received about 250 responses, qualitative responses to that. We took that information with the community and developed a series of draft recommendations based on that and sent those back out to the community and got over 300 responses to that. And the responses were overwhelmingly supportive of these recommendations. Some people were more supportive of and others less supportive, but in general, they supported all of them. And so the next step is for us to present these to city council. And this week, in fact, Taji and I and the steering committee will be meeting with the chiefs of staff of all of the city council offices to brief them on our recommendations and to push that these recommendations not just be another one of the million reports that city council gets and ends up on a shelf gathering dust somewhere, but that it's actually voted on by the city council to either approve or disapprove. And hopefully we'll gain the approval of city council and then we could move on to implementation. Now, some of these things are longer term projects. They're not going to happen overnight, but we believe Mike Myers as the community safety director would be a good person to sort of oversee the implementation of these recommendations. In terms of what the recommendations do, there's 13 of them. I won't go into great detail, but in general, what these recommendations speak to are the areas of policing that are currently handled by police that could be better and more effectively handled by other bodies. So, for instance, traffic safety. We have a recommendation that suggests taking traffic safety out of the hands of the police and giving it to an unarmed body of people who would be charged with enforcing traffic safety laws. The Portland police have already, in some sense, moved in that direction by saying that police will no longer be pulling people over for minor sort of vehicle infractions, like having a taillight out or having expired registration tags. And the reason why that particular recommendation is important is because in the course of those stops, the research shows that Black people are more likely to be searched and to consent to a search. There also is evidence of disparate policing against Black people, not only in Portland, but nationwide. And so what we want to do is stop policing that could lead to harm at the front end, so we don't have to deal with the consequences of mass incarceration, people being killed for interventions that could have been avoided. And speaking of that, I think we don't have to look too far back in Portland to see where involving the police in what is really a social health problem can go wrong. So last week, Michael Townsend, who had mental health problems, had addiction problems, called 911 indicating that he was suicidal. Initially, the fire and rescue show up. They call the police. They're trying to de-escalate the situation, talking to Michael Townsend. at which point he gets up and with this sharp object that is a tire repair implement and is in short order shot by the police. That incident, I believe, could have ended differently, and Michael Townsend would have been alive if the Portland Street Response, people trained to deal with people with addiction and mental health issues, had showed up instead of armed police. This is a person who was calling for help and ends up getting killed by the police. And that's precisely the kind of interaction that we want to stop in Portland.
Hi, folks. This is Cable Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here talking to Elliot Young for our Old Mole Variety Hour. Elliot Young teaches at Lewis and Clark. He teaches Latin American and Borderlands history. He's currently director of the Ethnic Studies Program and has directed Latin American Studies, published several books on borderlines, migration, and transnational history. Also a tireless activist and now serves as co-chair of the Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing. We've so far discussed some aspects of why replacing the police as first responders for a great variety of social and personal problems, it doesn't work. The question of homelessness, it seems to me, looms large because it takes up such an enormous amount of police activity. Tell us about that and tell us about the way intervening with homeless people would be so much more successful, and it has been successful in other cities, than having the police rouse them and make life miserable for the homeless.
Yeah, so we know based on a study done by the Oregonian about the 2017 arrests that over half, 52% of the arrests in 2017 were of people who were designated as homeless. That is an extraordinary statistic. It means that, in some sense, half of the resources of the Portland Police are dedicated to intervening and, in some sense, harassing homeless people. Now, if you look into what those arrests and those interactions involve, the vast majority of them are people who have failed to appear in court because they are homeless and don't have ways to receive notice, have difficulty getting to court, and therefore have warrants out for their arrest. They're trespassing. They're things like that. These are not, in the main, violent crimes that the police are being called to handle. So what happens when the police show up is that you have armed officers in uniform showing up to people who are, in many cases, dealing with the problems of not only of poverty, but often of mental health issues, of addiction issues, of past trauma, and they're triggered and traumatized by the arrival of police, and oftentimes people in that situation will react erratically. That can lead to police use of force. And it just cycles poor people into the criminal justice system, which is what has led to mass incarceration in the last 40 years in our country. It's essentially, these low-level interactions with the public, almost entirely poor people, has funneled people into jails and prisons across the country. That does harm to the people themselves. It's tremendously expensive. And it does not solve any of the problems that the people are experiencing. So what we are suggesting, and what has been suggested by many other advocates in the community, is that we take the police out of those interactions and that we follow the model that CAHOOTS has in Eugene of having an unarmed, trained group of people who could go out and connect people in need with services rather than further traumatizing and harming them. And the city council created the Portland Street Response for that very reason. It is currently a pilot project in the Lentz neighborhood. The city council in May was given the opportunity to expand that project citywide. I would add that in one of our recommendations is to expand Portland Street Response citywide And that was one of the recommendations that received the highest level of support from the community. But the city council, in a 3-2 vote, voted against that expansion. So Mayor Wheeler, Mingus Maps, and Dan Ryan voted against that. So those are precisely the kind of programs that we need so that we don't rely on police to deal with problems that are really public health problems. And without that, what we're going to get is continued sweeps of homeless people, which just moves them from one block to the next block without actually resolving the problems that people living on the streets are facing, or the issues, frankly, that housed people living in the neighborhood are complaining about, which is trash, human waste ending up on the street. All of those problems are real problems. The police do not solve those problems. What we need is a solution to those problems that do not involve the police. And frankly, the police that I've talked to indicate that they don't want to be involved in doing what is essentially social work. They realize they're the wrong tool for managing the problem of houseless people. So I think there could and should be a consensus in the city that we need to move the police out of dealing with homeless people and rather create and expand the responses like Portland Street Response, as well as significantly increase investment in services and housing for these people. Because without a solution at the back end, we're just going to have first responders constantly dealing with crises that would inevitably result from people living on the streets.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour on Cable Radio. I'm talking to Elliot Young. We've been discussing PSEP, the Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing. Elliot is a co-chair. They produced a recent report, Reimagining Community Safety. Anyway, Elliot, let's step back some from just the impact on people, which is terrible, but talk about the impact on society when it criminalizes homelessness and mental health emergencies. What are the sort of the larger impacts on the way ordinary people understand their society, understand poverty, but also on the other hand, how with the beneficial impacts of dealing with human troubles in non-punitive and supportive and helping ways? How do you see that bigger issue?
Yeah, so the criminal legal system has been set up through a series of laws to basically punish poor people. We go back to the 19th century, to the early 20th century, with vagrant laws where people who were found to be unemployed, living as transients, were basically picked up, put into prisons, and forced to do labor. And so there's a long history of the law sort of being created to target particular groups. But what we have with people living on the streets is a series of laws that basically criminalize them for the act of existing in space. They are doing things that any human needs to do, like go to the bathroom, that people in Irvington or in my neighborhood do in the privacy of their own houses, drink alcohol, maybe take drugs as well. All of those activities, when they're done in public, then can be criminalized. And since we don't have a network of publicly accessible toilets, people are forced to go to the bathroom on the streets. This is not a good thing for them. This is not a good thing for the community, but there simply is no choice for them until the city provides adequate housing and adequate bathrooms and hygiene services for these people. And the problem is that by creating this class of citizens or residents in Portland who don't have access to the basics of housing, of healthcare, of other kinds of basic needs, disengaged from the political process. And when they're disengaged from the political process, then you have a whole class of citizens who are not participating in our democracy. And that ultimately erodes the democratic nature of our society and the ability to continue to function as a democracy. And what you increasingly have is a small group at the top who have the money and resources to engage in politics and campaigns, and then this increasingly large number of people at the bottom who are subject to the laws and the police and the state violence, but actually have no say in who gets elected or what those policies are.
Yeah, Elliot, I have a hypothesis on that, that moving toward a society that helps people regain their footing, if we were going to show the success of that rather than policing, it would radically change people's perceptions towards a perspective that all of us at some point have troubles, that the poor are more likely to break down in public instead of punishing and making things worse, which demoralizes and angers people and, in fact, leads to even more troubled behavior. But helping and supportive intervention, it seems to me, it humanizes and moralizes. And it actually allows the people to come to terms with their life and strive to become more contributory citizens if they, in fact, have the opportunity to do that, which, in fact, most of them don't. But that would really create more democratic understandings and commitments across the society. And it seems to me that does create the foundations for a real democracy that not just permits but structures the society so all of us have something to say, that people have an opportunity to do it.
Yeah, I mean, basically, if you have people who are just struggling to survive day to day, to feed themselves, to find shelter, those people are not going to be able to participate in democratic decision making. They're not going to be able to fulfill their own potential as human beings. They're not going to be able to contribute to society at large. And so to the extent that we've created a society that relegates vast numbers of people into this situation of what some scholars have called bare life, just the bare existence, then we have created a structure that prohibits and prevents democracy from working. And so we need a massive reinvestment in human potential to allow those people to reach their fullest potential. And without that, we're just going to, as a society, continue to pay the price, and these individuals are going to pay the price in terms of disease, in terms of bad relationships, in terms of hunger, and oftentimes in terms of death. There are many homeless people who die on the streets of Portland every winter because they don't have access to shelter. And we know that many of the people who get killed by police are, in fact, people suffering mental health crises who've been failed by a system that does not provide adequate mental health care to lots of people in our society.
Finally, Elliot Young, the co-chair of the Committee for Community Engaged Policing, will be meeting with City Council staff. My guess is that some of the City Council men will be glad to meet, and I'm sure you'll get to them. What can people do now to support your recommendations and make sure that it's not only considered, but those recommendations are implemented and funded, perhaps with a lot of the money that could be saved from policing?
Yeah, so one of the things to do is, first of all, check out the proposal, Reimagining Community Safety. It's on the PSUB website, and look at those recommendations and then reach out to city commissioners by emailing them, letting them know what you think and that you support these measures. Ultimately, we will be going before city council. It's not clear exactly when. Hopefully in early July, we will be going before city council. And as we've been told, that won't be an opportunity for public comment. We will have some ability to have invited commentary, but I think that people could certainly send messages to their city commissioners and tell them that the mayor has set up a process for community to reimagine a community safety. And we have gone through that process. We've involved hundreds of people over the last few months in this process. And we've come up with a series of recommendations that is really a blueprint and a vision for the future. And the job of the politicians in a democratic society is to listen to the people and listen to the collective wisdom. And so we hope that they do and will move forward, because if we continue to go down the same path that Portland has gone down for the last few years, we will end up creating more homeless people, more people will be killed by police, and more harm will be done to the community at large.
Elliot Young, thanks for all the work you've been doing with the Community Engaged Policing Committee. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Bill. Thanks for informing the community about this work. And I just want to reiterate that this is not just the work of PSEP. This is the work of hundreds of Portlanders who put their heads together to try to imagine and reimagine a better Portland. We're looking forward to making change happen here in the city.
Thanks again, Elliot. Take care.
We're brave and gallant miner boys who work in underground. For courage and good nature no finer can be found. We work both late and early and get but little pay to support our wives and children in free America. If Satan took the blacklegs, I'm sure 'twould be no sin. What peace and happiness 'twould be for us poor working men. 8 hours we'd have for working, 8 hours we'd have for play, 8 hours we'd have for sleeping in free America.
Next on The Old Mole, we have Norm Diamond discussing Bloody Thursday.
Today is July 5th. It's a Monday, of course, for the Old Mole Variety Hour. But in 1934, July 5th came on a Thursday. Up and down the West Coast, we know that day as Bloody Thursday. For years before the coronavirus hit, I would spend the day at Oaks Amusement Park, part of a vast commemoration picnic with speakers, music, and free food for everyone in the park, hundreds if not a thousand or two, whether they knew about the occasion or not. At a certain point, a small group, many wearing distinctive white caps, would take a wreath down to the Willamette River, place it on the water, and set it free. Bloody Thursday is how we commemorate the 1934 Longshore Strike, one of the most formative events in Portland and West Coast history. Up and down the coast, Bloody Thursday is a holiday, with work on the docks stopped in remembrance. On that day, two strikers and a supporter were killed by police in San Francisco, setting off a chain of events that forced the Waterfront Employers Association to realize they had lost and the workers had won. Here's how Bill Bigelow and I set the stage in an essay we published in the Oregon Historical Quarterly in spring of 1988. On July 3, 5 truckloads of men, protected by 700 police, cruised slowly from the pier toward the warehouses. A police captain yelled, "The port is open!" The cry sparked a battle between thousands of strikers and their supporters and the police. 25 people were hospitalized. 2 days later, 5,000 people clashed with police. In what became known as Bloody Thursday, hundreds of people were injured and 3 were killed. The next day, California Governor Merriam dispatched the National Guard. Organized labor in San Francisco responded by calling a general strike. 130,000 workers walked off their jobs. Here's another account from California historian Fred Glass. On July 5th, what became known as Bloody Thursday, police bullets killed World War I veteran and longshoreman Howard Sperry and Marine cook Nick Bourdois a few feet from the Longshore Union Hall on Stewart Street. Their bodies lay in state in the building before being moved to the front of an enormous, silent funeral parade. Here he's quoting from the San Francisco Chronicle. The Chronicle story noted that alive, the two men wouldn't have commanded a second glance, but in death, they were borne the length of Market Street in a stupendous and reverent procession that astounded the city. Then back to Fred Glass. The discipline of the marching workers created solidarity among other crafts and trades, inspired an outpouring of sympathy in a previously wavering middle class, and scared the bejesus out of San Francisco's ruling elite. When Bill Bigelow and I wrote that Oregon Historical Quarterly piece, we were focusing primarily on what happened in Portland, how Portland workers organized their part of the strike, how they won community support, maintained morale, responded to local authority and police attacks. Here, too, strikers were assaulted and shot by police. I used to take people into Pier Park in North Portland to show them bullet holes in the trees. That's where police fired up from the railroad tracks at the park's edge while attempting to force their way by train through pickets into the Port of Portland's Terminal 4. The union that resulted from that strike's victory is the union that a couple of months ago acted in solidarity with Palestinian struggles, refusing to load a ship carrying goods to Israel. It's the union that inducted Angela Davis as a member last month on Juneteenth, joining her with Paul Robeson and Martin Luther King Jr. as its two other honorary members. It's the union that shut the Port of Portland in solidarity with the Occupy movement a few years back. It's the union that took in the workers at Powell's Bookstore on their third and successful attempt to organize. It's also the union that enabled the Portland police to form their own union and then, years later, forced the cops to back down in a crucial confrontation. That's a story worth retelling. It was May Day in the year 2000. Like nearly every place else in the country, Portland had not had a public May Day celebration for decades. But after the invigorating WTO protests in Seattle a few months before, and the large Portland contingent that joined in, we planned to celebrate International Workers' Day on May 1st with a joyous march and some motivating speeches. The response by the Portland police was brutal, attacking, beating, and attempting to discourage us from any public action ever again. It was only the newsroom footage gathered from TV helicopters above that days later gave the lie to the mayor's and police spin on the event and showed peaceful demonstrators under vicious attack. After various town meetings and public forums, the police chief, architect of a new militarized force, had to resign. But it's one incident from that day that's the point of this particular telling. A unified march had been broken into small groups, attacked and dispersed throughout downtown. With others, including my 13-year-old and his friend, I had been driven by mounted police from the waterfront up to Powell's. We weren't prepared to fight back, but were insisting on our right to demonstrate. We were on the north side of Burnside, facing a line of armored, helmeted cops, slapping their batons threateningly into their palms, ready to charge. Just as they started towards us, 400 longshore workers, members of the union that resulted from that 1934 strike, came up behind them on Southwest 10th. Their leader spoke a few words, and the cops walked away. It turned out that leaders up and down the coast of the ILWU, the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, were in Portland for their annual convention. What their president, Brian McWilliams, said to the police was this. He reminded them that the Portland Police Association would not have a contract with the city if the ILWU, together with the Teamsters, hadn't shut down the Port of Portland for 3 days to force the city into negotiations. He then said, whatever the cops decided, whether they remembered that history or not, the ILWU was coming through. The cops holstered their billy clubs and left, and we celebrated May Day together with the ILWU. Next year, 2001, the city council bought us a permit when we refused to apply for one, and we had a glorious May Day march of thousands. You can read about that 1934 strike and how it played out in Portland in the Oregon Historical Quarterly article I mentioned, or in our book, The Power in Our Hands, by Bill Bigelow and Norm Diamond. You can learn about the issues that led up to the strike and about the gains that were won. The context of the strike was the larger movement of the 1930s, the general strikes that happened elsewhere in the country also, the organizing of the unemployed and of farmers. There were major lessons the strike taught about maintaining rank-and-file activism, about enlisting community support, about the use of radio even, and about the importance of continuing militancy even after the strike was won. It was a victory that shaped our city and our region. Like all victories, it came at a cost. So today, July 5th, Bloody Thursday, I'll go down to the waterfront. All of the big strike's participants, whom I knew, are now dead, some not so long ago. I'll find a quiet spot and remember them and their struggle, and think about the struggles that came after and that continue. At some point, I'll put a little homemade wreath into the water and watch it float away. This has been Norm Diamond for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. Next on the Old Mole, we have Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker talking about the political landscape for crime and punishment in summer 2021.
Philadelphia, St. Louis, San Francisco, Chicago, Los Angeles, all of these cities have elected prosecutors with a sharply different vision of crimes and punishment than their predecessors. Ranging left liberal to radical, they have all upended the tough-on-crime narrative that has proved so profitable for politicians, a springboard to higher office all over the country. And these progressive prosecutors are an important victory of the Black Lives Matter movement and the fight for decarceration. So, Mike, how are these progressive prosecutors faring in the wake of the right-wing backlash against police reforms and rising anxiety about increases in violent crime?
Well, Jen, the news overall is good, although there has been stout resistance every step of the way from police unions, from prosecutors, even from judges who are used to the way things have been done for several decades now.
Can you talk about the role of prosecutors in the criminal justice system? We've taken this up before, but I think it's an often neglected hub of the machinery of the criminal justice system.
Well, they're the critical players. I think they're more important than judges. They're more important than legislators. They're more important than anyone because of the enormous discretion they have. They can and do choose who to prosecute and what to charge. So these people have, around the country, charged fewer people with crimes. They've made fewer enhancements. They no longer charge juveniles as adults. They've eliminated the death penalty. They've made moves toward ending cash bail. There are fewer police interactions in neighborhoods of color and poor neighborhoods. They're essentially trying to diminish the role of police and therefore of incarceration in our collective life.
So taking the case of Krasner, who had an important victory in May in Philadelphia, how did that campaign counter the opposition they faced that was clearly capitalizing on the increase in violent crime this year?
Well, that was a critical campaign for just that reason, because all of the scare talk that you hear from police unions and from supporters of the previous way of doing things has been about this explosion of gun violence, this rapid increase in crime, blamed, of course, on liberal prosecutors. But Krasner was facing exactly that situation in Philadelphia. But he argued that the fault was primarily of the pandemic. It's a shutdown of schools, summer camps, job opportunities. It was the elimination of those opportunities for young people who were committing all the crimes. We have a better understanding now of what has happened. The crime overall decreased, not increased. There are fewer rapes, fewer robberies. These are crimes of opportunity. The increase has been in gun violence because of large numbers of really ridiculously equipped guns that proliferate across this country. Most of the murders have happened, it turns out, in the same places they've always happened. There's been no spreading out beyond the normal boundaries of additional murders. So Krasner had all the bad statistics you could want, far worse than the statistics in Portland. But he pointed out successfully that the overall numbers are still far less than they were 20 or 30 years ago, that although the directionality is disturbing, it's had nothing to do with the prosecutors because the same increase has happened everywhere in the country, even where there are tough on crime prosecutors. And he won. He won decisively. He won because people have gotten used to and like these changes he's made. He's involving other parts of the community in restorative justice. He's spread out the criminal justice system, getting parts of it back from the police that have inherited so many different managerial tasks. And he prevailed. Now, it's a good sign, I think, for Chissa Boudin in San Francisco, George Gascon in Los Angeles, who are both facing recall campaigns. George Gascon in Los Angeles is facing a recall campaigns that started the day after his election. Many of his best ideas have been put on hold by judges who are accustomed to deferring to these tough-on-crime prosecutors who presented cases to them for many decades now. And Chissa Boudin is facing recall, but I think Krasner's results are very heartening. I think in both those cities, San Francisco and Los Angeles, there's serious money as well as lots of support for what they've done because they've spread out the criminal justice system to parts of the community that have been excluded from it, and as well as limiting its reach.
How do these progressive approaches to the work of the DA fit with the aims of abolitionists, police abolitionists?
They're central because, as I said, prosecutors determine who gets charged with what crimes and whether or not there will be any additional enhancements. So when the police, for example, here in Portland, brought dozens and dozens of charges against demonstrators or protesters, the DA could say, I'm not going to make these formal charges. I'm just not going to do it. The DAs can decide and have decided that they will not charge anybody for prostitution or for drug possession in a small jail. You've got enormous power, and the prosecutor is the beginning of the system. The police, of course, generate the raw material, but it's the prosecutors who determine who gets processed by the system.
So, Mike, let's talk about the drama here in Multnomah County and the confrontation between Mike Schmidt, the DA's office, and the rapid response team, or SWAT team, as they're known here in Portland. Officer Corey Budworth was indicted by a Multnomah County grand jury for fourth-degree assault of a protester last summer. And in response to those charges that will go forward, the entire rapid response team that had included Budworth resigned in protest. Many of them are regulars now on Fox News, expressing their outrage over Mike Schmidt and the failure of the criminal justice system to back up the police here in Portland, who, after all, have been extremely stressed by carrying out their dangerous work, protecting the public. That's kind of a summary of their stance. How would you describe this dramatic confrontation and the significance of the resignation en masse of the rapid response team in support of Budworth?
Jan, I see it as, although fraught with drama, as essentially politics as usual, with a soupçon of police misconduct overseeing it. If you break down what the police are complaining about, they are complaining about the fact that they are being held to the same standards of conduct as everyone else. They're saying that because of the danger and the stress and the difficulty of our job, the fact that we might have violated the law should be overlooked. It should be put in the larger context of how vital our work is. They're asking to be excused from following the law.
But the president of the police union claimed that his behavior conforms to standard police procedures. And then Mike Schmidt countered that if these are standard police procedures, we are in a very difficult situation indeed.
In some ways, it's not that hard. I mean, Schmidt has said he won't prosecute demonstrators, but he will prosecute window breakers. There's a difference. It's like the police have the authority to use a certain amount of force to restrain people in certain circumstances. But if they hit somebody or spray somebody or kick somebody for no discernible reason, that's an assault. That would be an assault if you or I did it, and it should also be an assault if a police person does.
It's a continuous refrain on the part of the police that, and supporters, even Biden, you know, and the Democrats try to pay tribute to the police who are out there every day protecting the public in the most dangerous line of work, like they're in the infantry in some war zone.
Well, it's exaggerated, as are every occupation when it's entering into, as our police are, political negotiations. The fact is that the job of being a cop ranks out of the top 25 dangerous jobs. It ranks as 22nd. It's nowhere near as dangerous as being a logger. It's less dangerous than being a crossing guard or a farmer. There's a host of jobs that are more dangerous, more risky. It's true, they must deal with people at their worst, people who are feeling tense. But the vast majority of cop work, it's demanding work like most work is. If you want to do a good job at any job, you have to be attentive. You have to be alert. And the police are saying that we should be somehow set aside from jobs, even jobs that have much higher mortality rates, in order to, I think, secure a better contract. They're essentially fighting the efforts to defund or to shift resources away from police departments. And they have sometimes been willing to give up responsibilities, like to concede to mental health workers first response in certain situations, but they want to keep their budget.
By the way, the en masse resignation of the rapid response team did not mean they were giving up their jobs. They still are employees. They are just, for now, not in that special unit. You know, I was looking up training for the rapid response team, and they are expected to be able to handle stressful situations, de-escalate. It reminds me, in medicine, you know, one of the most dangerous medical specialties is an ER doctor, because they see people who are very upset and reactive, but that doesn't give the ER doctor the right to assault them or use their medical arsenal, although sometimes they do, to quiet them. But you are, similarly in psychiatry or mental health field, you are trained to not take it personally when someone calls you names. You know, as a mental health professional myself, I've been in many situations where I've been dealing with people who are very hostile, and yet you're trained not to take it personally. Yet these riots,
it is the job of being a police officer.
It is the job. That's what you're paid to do, is to not take it personally. And so this kind of interests me as a side story. The SWAT team, with all of their massive arsenal and militarized presence, why they are not able to respond to protesters who are clearly angry at the police and probably do call them names. But that sense of outrage in response to demonstrators, and the claim that the police are so demoralized they can't find their replacements. I mean, what do you make of that? Is that just a rhetorical strategy to win more resources back?
It's that, and it's also personal, and it's also a sense of the world slipping through their fingers that they have owned so clearly. I mean, just 3 days ago, a Portland police officer who had been fired for blatant screw-ups on the job got his job back. It's virtually impossible to fire a cop in Portland, Oregon right now, no matter how ineffective or desultory, lazy, or mean he or she may be.
And why is that?
It has to do with the political structure of the police union, the whole structure of arbitration. There are efforts in the legislature to change that. There are efforts being made all over the place. Some of them are successful. Most of them are continue to fail, but they keep coming back. So the police are losing the sort of infinite amount of authority they've had in this town. There was a brief period when the Justice Department oversaw Portland's police department, primarily because the police kept shooting these mentally ill people. Since then, they've believed that they've gotten that burden removed from their shoulders. But now the whole Black Lives Matter movement and what happened in the wake of the murder of George Floyd has led to a significant loss of prestige and actual loss of material goods. People are renegotiating contracts all over the country, particularly here in Portland. And there was that long, strange period after the triumphant kicking out of the feds from the federal building downtown, where demonstrations continued, and I think they presented a picture of why it's a good thing rather than a bad thing that these people have all resigned, because I think a lot of the protesters and the cops were personally into it with each other, and it sort of degenerated through the fall, and the people who have resigned had all kinds of personal beefs and gripes with individuals. I think it's so much better to distribute that work, it's tough work, the nighttime work, around different members of the police department, rather than having the so-called specialized unit, because they have no particular additional skills. They were just people who were assigned to that job. But the mass resignation, as you say, it did not involve them actually resigning from their job. They resigned from a particular assignment.
So maybe we should celebrate their resignation.
It's not a bad thing in any way.
Not a bad thing. Okay. Okay, well, Mike, there'll be more to follow around these themes of law and order and decarceration as we continue. And I think it's important as we note the losses and defeats of social movements to also recognize their victories and the important advances through the mass movement over the last year and organizing of the Black Lives Matter movement.
That's right. It's been a very important victory, too, not just a superficial one. Getting control of a prosecutor's office and getting better prosecutors is key to really reforming or fundamentally changing our criminal justice system.
So this is Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker talking today about crime, violence, and politics as we enter into the hot summer of 2021 in the aftermath of the Black Lives Matter movement and the fight for decarceration.
You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Community Radio. A big thank you to KBOO staff who have been keeping our non-commercial community radio on the air 24/7 over this last year. It takes a labor. The Old Mole comes to you every Monday morning at 9 a.m. And thanks to our contributors and guests for making today's show possible. Bill Resnick, Elliot Young, Norm Diamond, Jan Hawken, and Mike Snedeker. You can hear The Old Mole on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, or download the Old Mole podcast and listen on the go. I'm Denise Morris, and I've been your host this morning. Tune in next week for more news, views, and interviews from a socialist, feminist, anti-racist perspective.